This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. It's the start of a new year politically, with the last week's State of the Union address and this week's State of the State, giving Wisconsinites an overview of the current condition of our country and state, and what can we expect in the coming year. Joining us today to give us insight into current and future political issues is Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind. So this week, Governor Walker gave a pretty optimistic assessment of Wisconsin in his annual State of the State address. What do you think of the current state of Wisconsin?
Well, you know, Hope, first of all, it's great to be back home and catching up with some listening sessions back here, too, getting feedback from people what they're hoping to see coming out of Washington this year, or maybe not see coming out of Washington this year. But, you know, I tuned in a little bit to what the governor had to say. I obviously was in attendance for the president's State of the Union address. And the president gave a very forward-looking, hopeful, optimistic outlook of where we are as a nation. And the bottom line is that I wouldn't change our position right now, either as a state or as a country, with anyone else around the world. There are a lot of good economic indicators pointing in the right direction. Unemployment's going down. Job opportunities are increasing. Inflation is almost nil. We've got energy costs at an all-time low right now because of a lot of domestic production that we're seeing. But we're not there yet as far as expanding economic opportunities for all of our citizens here in Wisconsin or across the country. And I think the president and I think the governor would be the first to admit there's more work to be done right now.
And so it's interesting you bring up these listening sessions, you know, kind of around this area. What are you hearing from people that they want to see kind of in the coming year?
You know, some of it is presidential politics because it's in our face 24/7. You can't avoid it. And so everyone has an opinion about the presidential race. But it's bread and butter issues. You know, it's how to make ends meet. It's too many families still struggling to make ends meet. Access to affordable health care and what we can do to try to keep health care costs manageable. Access to affordable education for our children, especially higher education in light of student indebtedness. The job market, too. What more we can be doing back home to protect the beautiful natural resources that we're blessed with here throughout western Wisconsin. So these are some of the bread and butter issues that I hear quite a bit, along with the threat of terrorism and the concern people have, whether we as a nation are doing enough or as much as we need to in order to better protect and make secure our country, our citizens, both at home and abroad.
Another thing that you know, Governor Walker introduced in his State of the State address was his 2020 vision project, his plan to hold listening sessions throughout the state to kind of see what Wisconsinites want to happen in the future. You know, do you think this is maybe the beginning or leaning towards a third campaign for governor?
I don't know about that, but I always applaud any representative who takes time to listen to the people. You know, ever since I've been in office, I always, every year, travel to each county multiple times for listening sessions in order to get feedback. Because I've found that by doing that, there are a lot of good ideas back here, a lot of different perspectives that need to be heard. And people need to have access to their representatives at whatever level of government that we might be serving. So I'm encouraged that the governor's going to be taking time out of his schedule to do that. I think it's important for him, given the feedback that I've been hearing around the state and the fact people do realize that we have been underperforming as a state in comparison to our neighbors when it comes to job growth, when it comes to new startups, when it comes to just the entrepreneur environment that we need here as a state. And hopefully the governor can internalize that and then lead to a good agenda that's going to make sense for our state. But I tell you, the more listening I think elected representatives do, the better they're able to do their job. And so I encourage the governor to take full advantage of that.
So college affordability is definitely a national issue, but it's also been, you know, a part of several of the things that Walker's been talking about here on a state level, and has introduced, you know, several reforms that he's kind of championing as a way to address some of these issues. You know, what changes do you think need to be made either on a state level or on a national level to kind of make college more affordable?
Well, first of all, I think what the governor came out recently, it's a step in the right direction, but it's scratching the surface. And there's a much bigger problem than he may realize. We've got to keep our eye on access to quality educational opportunities back home here. And it's really a three-pronged approach, Hope. One is the affordability issue and student indebtedness in particular. You know, the average undergraduate here in Wisconsin is graduating with close to $28,000 worth of debt by the time they finish their technical or four-year school career, and sometimes even more than that. And so there are federal programs, financial aid programs, that ought to be supported and invested in. Pell Grants, Work Study, Gear Up and TRIO for lower income students, access to the affordability of student loans at a lower interest rate. We should allow students to consolidate their loans and then refinance at a lower rate, something that Senator Schilling and Representatives Doyle and Billings and Danow have been talking about in this area for some time. You know, Minnesota's allowing students to do that. Other states are. I don't know why we in Wisconsin are not allowing our students to do that. Another aspect of it, though, is asking the higher ed institutions to do a better job as far as cost containment and efficiencies to try to deliver a quality product at an affordable price. And so that's the other side of the ledger, is why are costs going up so much in the higher education field? And then finally is the quality piece. I mean, you can't get too far away from this conversation without actually looking at the return on investment and the quality that either our tech schools or our universities or colleges are offering our students. That means graduation rate. It means placement rate. It means what type of lifelong learning skills our students are developing in their education career to meet the demands of a global economy. And let's face it, we are in a global economy, and the rest of the world isn't waiting for our state to get our act together. And one of the more discouraging things, Hope, to be honest, is what I've seen over the last few years, and that's the disinvestment in education as a state, whether it's preschool, whether it's K through 12, especially higher ed. And the governor's budget last time called for another $250 million worth of cuts in higher education funding. Minnesota is noticing, and they see Wisconsin on a fire sale, and they are not shy coming and recruiting off from our campuses some of the best and brightest teachers, professors, researchers that we have. And we are in danger of developing a reputation as a state of devaluing higher education. And once you develop that reputation, it's tough to shake. So we better be careful where we're going with our support for education, or we're going to be digging ourselves out of a hole for a long time to come.
Do you think that maybe has something to do with, you know, a lot of Walker's talk in the state of the state with, you know, investing more in K through 12 and looking at that? Do you think that's a response?
I hope it is. I hope it's feedback that he's getting, you know, from all circles, including the business community who need that talent coming off from these campuses for the job placements that they have. But it's fundamental. I mean, there are two great equalizers in our society. One is the ballot box. It doesn't matter who you are. Every vote is supposed to count the same. And the other one is access to a quality education. That's the other great equalizer. And you cannot grow and sustain a great state without a great education system, educating our students, and then creating the environment that enables them to stay here in Wisconsin to deploy their talents, so we're not losing them to other states or to either of the coasts. And we're in danger of that, too. I can't tell you how many young, bright students who want to go into teaching, want to go into education, are tell me they don't see a future for them here in Wisconsin because of the way it's been demonized, and they're looking to other states, you know, for those type of employment opportunities. That too is going to be very harmful for our long-term growth outlook.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Wisconsin's 3rd District U.S. Representative Ron Kind about current issues in both Wisconsin and the U.S. So, you know, turning more toward, back towards college affordability, yeah. I mean, that's obviously been part of several candidates' presidential campaigns and definitely one of those kind of hot topics. You know, how much change or how much do you think that we're going to see that kind of return both in November and the actual election and also when we see a new president?
You know, I hope really that this presidential race will be a defining moment as far as the agenda that our nation needs to stay the most competitive, the most innovative, the most creative nation in the world. You can't do that without quality educational opportunities for our students at home. You can't do it without basic research funding. You can't do it without laying the groundwork with a healthy infrastructure system that enables long-term sustainable economic growth. You can't do it without broadband deployment, so no community, no business, no household is left behind in the 21st century communications highway that we have right now. So I hope this becomes an opportunity for our nation to really come to grips about the policy that we need in order to support that economic infrastructure, our education system. And we have a vehicle coming up this year in Congress, the Higher Education appropriation bill is up for reauthorization. We have to do this every 5 years. I've been paying very close attention to it. I've introduced legislation called the Higher Education Affordability Bill, which I think are some common sense measures that don't cost a lot that can alleviate the debt burden that students are facing right now, you know, such as the consolidation of loans, the lower interest rates, allowing them to pay back their loans based on their income level. So if their income goes up, they can pay a little more. If it doesn't, they don't have to declare bankruptcy or default on their student loan obligations. And then let's charge them the same interest rates that the big banks on Wall Street are currently being charged, which are at rock bottom prices. I think if it's good enough for the big banks on Wall Street, it should be good enough for our students throughout the country. And that would save them tens of billions of dollars every year through those lower interest rate charges. So there are, I think, some common sense steps that we can take, and the higher education bill could be a vehicle for doing it. And I hope we're able to, in the course of the year, come together in a bipartisan fashion and put together a solid bill that makes sense for our students so that those who want to go on to advance their education career are able to without worrying about a lifetime of indebtedness.
Mm-hmm. And how much do you think that, high student loan debt for a lot of our younger generations, you know, do you think that's had an effect on our national economy?
I think it absolutely has. It's holding us back. It's a drag. I mean, when you come out with a huge debt load, you're not a good consumer. And it's hard for you to make that first car purchase, hard for you to make that first home purchase, or just be supportive of the community in the way that we would want them to. And it's because of that debt that's hanging over their head. And right now, we got $1.2 trillion nationwide of student debt. It's more than all credit card debt combined in the country for the first time. So I don't want to see student debt to be the next economic bubble that bursts and brings down the U.S. economy along with it. So there's a very strong economic reason for doing this and getting it right, not just to make it easier for students, but to strengthen and grow our economy at the same time.
Another issue that we've seen, you know, across the state of Wisconsin, but especially on this side of the state, is rail safety. And a lot of citizens concerned with regulations of rail safety measures. And we've also seen several local lawmakers introduce legislation on a state level right. to kind of address that. But, you know, what's kind of going on a federal level?
Well, I've teamed up with Senator Tammy Baldwin, a lot of rail safety initiatives in that, along with working with state and local community leaders. We have a major rail corridor right through our backyard here in western Wisconsin. Unfortunately, it's hemmed in between the bluffs, and it's right next to one of the most beautiful national wildlife refuges in the entire world, the Upper Mississippi Wildlife Refuge. So I do not want to see western Wisconsin be on the map for a news story about a major train derailment that involves this Bakken oil, which is very toxic, very flammable, very dangerous, and having that impact people's lives, but also the resources and the wildlife that we have around here. So I've introduced legislation with Senator Baldwin, along with Senator Heitkamp of North Dakota, called the Response Act. This would provide more training for local first responders, and they will be on the first line if anything does happen. We've been pressing the railroads to step up their inspection, their upgrade of the rail cars, so we have more modern and less puncture-proof rail cars transporting this toxic material. And I will shortly be introducing legislation that would require the railroads to forward deploy the foam that we need in order to put out oil fires. You just don't throw water on it because that just spreads the oil around. You need the foam. And by working with the state DOTs, this would require the railroads to pay a fee for those that are transporting this toxic substance so that we can respond in a much quicker fashion. You know, we learned that lesson down in Galena, Illinois, last year when we had that Bakken oil train derailment. Fortunately, it was in a rural area, so there weren't lives that were at stake, but it took a while for the foam to get there. And I think there's a common sense solution for that and legislation that I intend to introduce. But the railroads have a major responsibility here. They have to step up and be a good community leader on this, working with the local communities. And as I have the listening sessions, again, it's a constant issue that comes up for discussion is what more we can be doing to further enhance rail safety through our communities.
Mm-hmm. And obviously the states that have been affected by Bakken oil and are experiencing the more of the trains that are coming through are aware of this issue. But do you think, you know, the rest of the nation is kind of paying attention to rail safety?
You know, it's a one-off. When there's a news story, they do. They say, oh, that's too bad. And they see the flames and the people's lives that are impacted. But then people move on, you know, to the next story. And that's why it's really incumbent upon us representatives to stay focused on this and not get distracted. Another issue I've been pressing the railroads for through legislation and otherwise is better transparency and reporting requirements so that they notify the local communities what's traveling through those rail lines so that our first responders, state, federal, and local agencies have a better idea of what is being transported and when, so we have a better chance of reacting to it. So there, it's multifaceted. It's complex. But there are answers to this, and with the number of derailments that we've seen nationwide, but also the one that was up in Ottawa, Canada, that lost 44 lives because of it, this is a pressing issue and one that I've very much focused on, just given the rail corridors in the district that I represent.
So, you know, obviously we're talking about, Bakken Oil, and over the past year, you know, we've really seen gas prices. They're incredibly low all across the country right now. And, you know, part of that, those lower gas prices are coming from the increased oil production in the right. U.S. You know, we're also seeing natural gas prices lower than what we've experienced before, you know. And my question is, you know, at what cost to the environment are we seeing a lot of these lower prices and more of these resources?
Well, it's a great question for all of us to be asking, is at what expense in that? We've had now historically low gas prices. You got to go back to the early 70s, really, for gas at the pump that we're seeing right now. And in a lot of ways, it's unprecedented for many of our lives to see gas this cheap when you discount it for inflation. And a large part of that is due to the increased domestic production that we've had with fracking and the oil production here at home. Also, there's been a bit of a global slowdown, too, so the demand for oil overseas, especially in China, has ebbed, and OPEC has not cut back production. You know, Saudi Arabia is trying to squeeze the smaller producers, so they're cranking up production, and that's leading to an oil glut on a global basis. How long it lasts, no one can really say for certain, but certainly prices have plummeted. It means more money in people's pockets who have to fill up at the pump. It means a lot of savings in heating costs this winter, along with El Nino, with the warmer temperatures that we've been enjoying. So we could be at historically low heating expenses for the upper states as well. And all of this should provide a boost to the economy, helping the consumer, you know, make ends meet during this time. But there's also an environmental impact, as you point out. And we still need to be investing in the next generation of energy that we need that will be sustainable and long-serving, the alternatives in the renewables. One of the success stories that don't get told too often is just the increased fuel efficiency standards that we've required the car companies to meet, whether it's cars and trucks now are becoming more fuel efficient. But whenever you see a drop in oil prices, you see a drop in gas prices, fuel prices, and you see an explosion in truck sales as a consequence too. So all of this has to be taken into account because global warming is real. It is carbon-based, and for us to preserve and protect this planet for future generations, I think we have to be smarter consumers of the energy we need, which means investment in more alternative and renewable energy sources that are much more sustainable for our planet in the long run.
And you mentioned fracking, and obviously frack sand mining has been, you know, or maybe was, is the more appropriate term now, a huge kind of a booster of the economy, but, you know, we're seeing a slowdown. What do you think is going to kind of happen with that industry in the next coming years?
You know, it's a good question. You know, when you have an increase in oil prices like we did, there's a big boon in build-out and production, and a lot of people jump in. And I always get worried when that happens because bubbles are created, and then when the tide goes out, you find out who's been swimming without swimming suits on. And we're starting to see that now. I think you're seeing the smaller competitors starting to get caught holding the bag here with a sudden plummeting of prices, and they didn't have the capital reserves or the financing that they need to stay in business. So that now is being leveled off in the industry right now, a great shakeout that is occurring. And it's impacting frack sand mining, too, here in Wisconsin. And there's been a lot of that build out in a very rapid pace that I didn't think was going to be sustainable in the long run. And the impact that that's going to have on communities is still to be determined. So there's going to be a lot of change in the energy industry for some time. But right now, all indications are we're looking at energy prices remaining low throughout 2016, barring some external event that we don't see right now. And just given the overall general global slowdown and reduced demand for oil, you're probably going to be looking at some oil prices for quite some time. There's both pros and cons to that. You know, obviously cheaper energy prices for all of us consumers, but a major shakeout in the energy sector right now and a lot of jobs being lost as a consequence.
That's Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind here with us today to talk about current political issues on both the state and national level and what Wisconsinites can expect in the coming year. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. So after, you know, a recent investigation into some of the issues at the Tome of VA, you know, this has really sparked a national conversation about the VA system. And I know that you, as well as Senator Baldwin, have introduced legislation kind of dealing with some of these issues. Do you want to tell us a little bit about, you know, some of the things that you've been looking at?
I mean, it is a very important issue, not only the investigations that were coming out of the Tome of VA, but this is a national problem that we have throughout the entire healthcare sector. I don't want to just look at TOMA and say we just need to fix that and problem solved. It's bigger than TOMA, it's bigger than the VA system. It's really a healthcare epidemic that we're seeing with opiate use, how we manage pain in our country. And quite frankly, we just haven't done a very good job at it. And it hasn't been a lot of metrics or science-based study being done as far as what the proper course of treatment should be for patients who have pain management issues. We ought to be looking at more alternative and complementary forms of medicine. There needs to be more of a collaborative team approach in treating patients, something that they got away from in TOMA because it was one person's word, and if anyone second-guessed it, there was retaliation, and that was intolerable, and steps have been taken now to correct that. And I was so happy because I've had conversations with the president himself about this, that he made this one of his priority issues during the State of the Union address, an opiate nationwide strategy in order to deal with this problem throughout the healthcare system. And it's long past due in order to do it. And quite frankly, we owe it to our veterans to do everything we can to make sure they're getting the quality of care that they earned and that they deserve. I'm pleased with the steps that have been taken at TOMA, the reforms that have been implemented, you know, starting with John Rohr, who was the interim director, who is now the permanent director at Madison VA. I'm very glad that he recently was appointed to that post. And now it continues with Victoria Braum as the interim director there. But it's a more collaborative approach. It's more feedback from the staff and from families and patients alike as far as what the proper course of treatment is. And that's very much the legislation that Senator Baldwin and I introduced is based on those concepts. Named after Jason Simkowski, who lost his life at TOMA. And it's all those things, more collaborative, more team, more science-based research, more alternative and complementary forms of medicine approach, but equally important, more of an input from the veterans and the family members themselves as far as what's working and what isn't. And I'm convinced that it's really the family members that are first line of defense because they know if something's working and not working for the loved one in their lives. And we ought to have a system that's more conducive to them providing feedback and input on treatment regimens than what we've had in the past.
We've heard some veterans and some people say that, you know, the VA system just really isn't working anymore. There's too many problems with it, and that, you know, switching to a system where veterans could seek healthcare at, you know, regular hospitals, you know, doesn't have to be a VA hospital, would be a better system. I mean, do you think there's hope for the VA system in making some reforms?
Well, I can say that when the investigations came to light in the media, in public and that, I probably had more veterans contact me in person or by email or phone just to tell me how pleased and happy they are with the care and treatment that they were getting at TOMA because they didn't feel that story was getting out. It was only the negative stories and this was what's wrong and there are problems here. And I was a little taken aback that there were so many veterans going out of their way. They didn't have to, but just to point out, hey, I've been going to TOMA and I'm very happy with the care and treatment that I've been receiving there. So I don't want people to be misinformed that it's only problems. There is a lot of quality work also being done at TOMA and throughout the VA healthcare system. I'm a big believer in it because I think there's a niche that they play that your private healthcare providers don't, and that's the community and the experience in working with veterans. And that shared background that veterans have. And part of the care and treatment there is veterans working with each other in that type of context that they can't get at some other hospital or some other healthcare entity. But are there problems that need to be addressed? Absolutely. We should not be satisfied with where the VA is right now. Neither should we be satisfied with where the overall healthcare system is right now. There's still a lot of work and a lot of area of improvement that has to occur. But there's also, let's not fool ourselves, a political agenda out there to shut down the VA, and it's based on political ideology. It's the fact that some don't like the fact that there is a government-run healthcare system treating our veterans. But we try to accommodate their views by offering a new program that gives veterans the option, if they can't get an appointment, if they can't get into a VA center, they can go to a private provider then and get an appointment. And the VA will reimburse that provider for the costs of doing that. There's still wrinkles to be worked out in the so-called Choice Act that was passed. But it does open up the options for veterans that if they want to go to Gunderson or a Mayo, instead of having to go to Tomah or Madison or up to the Twin Cities for any major healthcare-related issues, they have that option.
Wisconsin's 3rd District U.S. Representative Ron Kine is here with us today to talk about current events in Wisconsin and the U.S. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation with Congressman Kine. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kine about what political issues Wisconsinites can expect in 2016. And so what are some of the biggest things that you're hoping to focus on in the next year?
You know, it may not be conventional thinking, given it's a presidential race and the politics are kind of dominate this year, but I think there are some issues, some common ground that we can focus on to bring us together to get things done in this year. You know, I mentioned the higher education reauthorization bill coming up. It's due, and there's a way for us to come together and put together a nice bill that can address student indebtedness, the affordability issue, and also more standards for accountability of higher education institutions. A lot of focus lately on criminal justice reform, bipartisan focus on that. That too, I think, speaking as a former prosecutor, special prosecutor in this area, I think is ripe for attention right now. And there's a lot of interest in moving forward on a criminal justice reform package this year. There is a pending major trade agreement with the Pacific Rim Nations right now that is up for consideration for Congress. Listen, I believe that we got to be in the game when it comes to trade. We're only 4% of the global population. This trade agreement gives us the opportunity to establish the rules of trade, which can be enforced if other countries don't live up to their bargain. It's an attempt to elevate standards up to where we are when it comes to worker rights, environmental protections, human rights issues, to level the playing field for our workers, for our businesses, our farmers here at home, so they can more effectively compete in the global economy. This is not an issue of whether we're going to be trading with Vietnam or Malaysia or Singapore or Brunei. We already are. This is merely an issue about what the rules of trade are going to be. And I think we've negotiated a pretty good trade package that does level the playing field more for our folks back home here so we can do a better job of competing. And if other nations don't live up to those rules, then we can sanction them. There are remedies to sanction them for not doing it. And then there's going to be focus on the terrorist threat, the ISIS threat that we have now, too. And that's probably going to be a major point of debate in the presidential race. But if anyone thinks that the answer is just putting the 82nd Airborne or the 101st Airborne Division back in the middle of that Sunni-Shia split, unless they want to own that for the next 40 or 50 years, there's a smarter strategy in combating terrorism than us just putting boots back on the ground in what is, in essence, a civil war that's been raging throughout the Middle East throughout the millenniums. So those are some major items coming up. And then obviously, the president's focused on opiate usage, too, in this country. I think there's a lot of bipartisan consensus on steps that can be taken to deal with that issue as we move forward. And in hearing from opiate abuse and heroin abuse, too, in Wisconsin, this, too, is a major item that we ought to be focused on.
And returning back to the issue of ISIS and terrorism that you were just talking about, what do you think, we need to be doing to kind of combat the issue of terrorism and protect ourselves?
ISIS is Sunni, and we need to empower the Sunni nations and the moderates of those nations to isolate and eradicate the ISIS threat themselves so that a group cannot hijack their religion and commit unspeakable acts of violence and terror in the name of Islam. So, and there's that effort. The president has led the coalition building effort throughout the Middle East right now, as well as eliciting the support of Sunni nations that are opposed to what ISIS stands for and what they're trying to do in the region. It's through that collaboration of the countries dealing with their own backyard, dealing with their own neighborhood, that any of this can be sustainable in the long term. I have no doubt, Hope, that if we did put the 82nd or the 101st Airborne in, they could take the fight to ISIS. There's no question. But it's what the day after looks like that we also need to be asking. And I don't think those questions were asked well enough or thought about well enough when it came to Afghanistan and Iraq. And we've seen where that has left us now, creating vacuums of power that groups like ISIS are more than happy to try to fill. So if you're going to have a long-term sustainable strategy, it's more than just bombs, it's more than just troops and military. It's making sure that the Sunni people and the Sunni nations themselves reject that extreme form of ideology in ISIS. Only then do you have a hope of being able to eradicate the threat there and abroad for a very long time.
Recently, here in Wisconsin, but also just abroad, there's been talk of just the way that these issues have kind of created, people are calling it Islamophobia, mm-hmm. and just like a fear and a misunderstanding of Muslim people. How do you think that we as a nation need to address that?
First, it's not demonizing a religion. It's not demonizing a whole people just because of some bad apples, some bad actors that claim to be doing this in the name of Islam. They're not. And the idea that we just need to ban Muslims now from our nation or not accept Assyrian refugees is not the Wisconsin way. It's not the American way. Quite frankly, we've had a very successful refugee replacement program here in the United States that's been very much in coordination with the faith-based communities here in Wisconsin and throughout our nation. It's worked very, very well. Can we increase our vetting process, for those families or individuals coming from ISIS-held territory like Syria and Iraq? No question. In fact, I supported legislation earlier this year that would require our intelligence and defense and National Director of Intelligence agencies to better collaborate and to share information when it comes to the vetting process. It was the failure of them to do that that led to 9/11, because they were each operating in their own silo, and they weren't sharing information with one another. The bill that we passed merely requires them to do a better job of coordinating the vetting process, and then they're certified. The people that we're bringing in are safe, that they don't pose a risk to the American people, which they can very easily do. So, yeah, there are some common sense steps that we can take, but the idea that we just need to, raise the drawbridge and erect huge walls around us is foolhardy. We're much too integrated with the world today, nor is it the image that we want to project as Americans, because the rest of the world is looking for our leadership. They're looking for a rational approach to this. And unfortunately, what we've been getting from some of the presidential candidates is nothing but fear-mongering and trying to scare people.
And you mentioned the legislation that you supported in November, I believe that was, for expanding the screening process for Syrian and Iraqi refugees. You know, where is that legislation, and what are we going to be seeing for some of those changes?
Well, it did pass the House. It's pending before the Senate. And unfortunately, we just saw 2 weeks ago that there were some Syrian refugees in Texas and California that were just arrested for plotting terrorist activity. So for those who claim, well, there's no threat at all from accepting Syrian refugees in that, well, we have a couple of examples right now where fortunately we were able to intercept some of their communications and take action before they had a chance to act here in the United States. But I think there was a lot of controversy around the bill. The bill is very simple. It was one page. In fact, Speaker Ryan, Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, called me a couple of times to get my feedback because he had elements in his party that wanted to just shut down the refugee program entirely or to defund it or to start banning Muslims, no matter where they came from coming in the United States. And I told Speaker Ryan that if they went down that road, it's a dark alley that we ought not go down, and especially the idea of applying religious tests for the first time in our nation's history. And to Speaker Ryan's credit, he agreed with me, and he came forward with a bill that stripped all that stuff out and came forward with the idea that let's just require our intelligence agencies to coordinate information sharing when it comes to the vetting process and then have the administration certify that, to the best of their knowledge, the people we're bringing in don't pose a security threat to the American people. And that's it. That's all the bill did. But it was in the context of Donald Trump saying no Muslims whatsoever and kind of the political hyperbole at the time. So I think a lot of people were confused in regards to what the legislation actually called for.
And do you think that there are other changes that might need to be made to the way that we accept refugees or immigrants?
Yeah, you know, the visitor visa is another issue that the House of Representatives took action on late last year. And if you're coming from one of our allied European Union nations, you can get a visitor visa very easily and come and visit the United States to up to 6 months. And there's been very little background checks being done with that. But we've seen now with the influx of immigrants and refugees going into Western Europe, that could be another easy port of access to the United States. So the administration, the president agrees that we ought to be doing more to tighten up the visitor visa program too, making sure that we're doing a better job of vetting that. I think the V1 program for future spouse program in light of San Bernardino is another area that we need to tighten up to make sure that we're vetting those individuals much more thoroughly. So we don't bring in terrorists under the guise of some spousal program. So, yeah, I think we're scrubbing this. We're trying to be smart about it. We're trying to anticipate our vulnerabilities, and hopefully we're checking all the boxes. But you can never, with 100% certitude, guarantee that we're catching everything all the time. That's just the nature of terrorism. It could be some lone wolf that's impacted by the propaganda that's available over the internet that decides to act in any of our communities. And unfortunately, that's the world in which we live today.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Wisconsin's 3rd District U.S. Representative Ron Kind about current issues in both Wisconsin and the U.S. And so, you know, we're obviously nearing a presidential election, but that also means, you know, President Obama is coming to the end of his term. And so, you know, just kind of looking back over his time as president, you know, what's your kind of evaluation of what he's been able to accomplish, or maybe what he's hasn't been able to accomplish?
Well, I think history is going to be kind to the Obama administration for one major reason, and that is on the day he raised his hand and took the oath, we were in an absolute economic freefall. People may not remember the conditions. I do, because I lived through it. And I was sitting there in Congress wondering how bad this was going to get. But we were losing over 800,000 jobs a month. A month at the time he became president of the United States. The whole lending finance industry had completely shut down. It was completely frozen. And everyone knows that it's access to liquidity and capital that's the lifeblood of any economy. And loans just stopped because banks didn't know who they could trust, whether it's businesses or other banks that they were going to borrow money or loan money to. So everyone just froze and it just locked up. He also inherited from day one a $1.5 trillion budget deficit. which has now been reduced by over two-thirds with the economic growth that we have seen. In fact, we've had over 72 consecutive months now of private sector job growth, had a very healthy job growth year last year where we were averaging over 220,000 new jobs every month versus 800,000 jobs being lost. And most of the economic indicators right now are pointing in the right direction. But he'd be the first to admit that there's more work that needs to be done, that working families are still struggling too much, that wages have not kept up. And you know, the truth is that when you have a deep financial recession, this great recession that we're coming out of, it's usually wages that are the last thing to recover from it. Usually you need strong, sustainable job growth and a tightening of the labor market before wages start going up. And we started seeing signs of that last year again. And hopefully that will continue. And then families will start feeling more financially secure again. But he also passed comprehensive health care reform. Everyone said that's impossible given the politics of the moment and how divisive that issue is. And ever since Teddy Roosevelt that was calling for major health care reform, it was his presidency, his administration, that was finally able to do it. Not that it was a perfect answer to the complexities of the health care system, but it now puts in place certain tools to reform a health care system so we get a better bang for the buck that we are spending. We have health care delivery reform. We have payment reform that's rewarding more value as opposed to volume of care. And now over 20 million people who didn't have health care coverage in their lives do for the first time because of this health care reform. But we now need to be smart enough as a nation to recognize what is working and what isn't and make adjustments along the way. And I think there has been some progress made on the threat that we face abroad. I think this administration has taken a more coalition-building approach, that it's not just going to be the U.S. military riding to the rescue whenever there's a problem in someone's neighborhood in the Middle East, that we're going to ask them to put skin in the game. We're going to ask other nations to up their involvement in combating elements like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and that it's not just our military doing all the heavy lifting all the time. I think that's a much smarter approach from our point of view, and it's much more sustainable in the long term anyway. So you factor in all of that, progress has certainly been made from the god-awful conditions that he inherited as president from first day. But I think he'd also admit that he was frustrated with the lack of progress on a lot of issues and just how polarized and how hyper-partisan everything has gotten recently in the American political scene. And I don't know if there's an easy solution to that, but it is very frustrating, especially for someone like myself who does believe in consensus building, coalition building, trying to find common ground. And there's just still too much name-calling and finger-pointing rather than trying to find honest solutions to the challenges that we all share as Americans.
Do you, you know, you bring up this issue of very polarized politics right now in our country. Do you think that that's going to continue with the next president, or do you think that there's hope of finding a candidate who might be able to bring the two together?
You know, there are answers to it, and I was glad the president devoted some of the State of the Union last week to some of the political process reforms that we need right now, starting with redistricting. It is not right that the politicians get to choose their voters, and yet that's the way the redistricting process is set up right now in too many states. Other states have shown, by example, Iowa, Washington, Oregon, that you can set up nonpartisan commissions to draw the political map. I wish Wisconsin would adopt that as a goal for our state so that we have districts that are more reflective of the people of Wisconsin rather than loading up a bunch of Republicans or a bunch of Democrats in these districts. That, I think, has increased the polarization of politics. We got to continue to figure out a way to get the big money and the dark money out of the political system. This unaccounted for super PACs, the average person has no idea where this money is coming from. And it's going to lead to either corruption or some big scandal. And I hope it doesn't come to that before politicians are smart enough to start revising that system. But it took Watergate, obviously, for the last real series of election reforms to actually be implemented. And then we ought to be making it easier for people to participate in our democracy rather than erecting artificial barriers to them. And unfortunately, Wisconsin under Governor Walker has led the way when it comes to voter ID and voter suppression measures, making it harder for certain people in the state to participate, to cast their vote. That's wrong. I mean, that really gets to the guts of our democracy and one of those great equalizing things I was talking about before. why we feel that there's a need to make it harder for people, citizens of this state, to be able to participate and vote come election time is beyond me. It's heading in the wrong direction from where we need to be going.
Another kind of political or switch or, you know, another political figure rising is Paul Ryan becoming Speaker of the House. And yeah. I know that, you know, because he's also from Wisconsin, you guys have worked in the past and had relations together. Do you think him becoming Speaker has changed any of that?
Well, it's too early to tell. But for one, I'm happy we have a Speaker from Wisconsin for the first time because there are certain advantages to having that. I've had a good working relationship with Paul Ryan. Listen, we do disagree on a lot of issues and kind of our philosophical approach to governance and that. But we also tend to work well together when it comes to Wisconsin-specific issues. So that, I think, is going to be beneficial to our state ultimately. But I think it's too early to tell because I don't think the problem was Speaker Boehner before, and I don't think the problem is with Paul Ryan. The problem was there's a certain element within the Republican Party who has a problem with the Constitution. And the Constitution, the way it's drafted, makes things hard. It's about divided government. It's about checks and balances. It's about forcing cooperation and collaboration and compromise. And too many of my colleagues recently have gotten elected with this my way or no way at all attitude. And that's a recipe for disaster for any democracy. No democracy can survive if you come with it with a dictatorial attitude. You need to talk to each other, listen to each other, work hard to find common ground. And we'll see whether or not Paul Ryan is more successful in dealing with that element within his party than Speaker Boehner was before him. But, you know, people need to wrap their heads around the fact that our Constitution really forces compromise and cooperation between the parties or nothing ever gets done. And it's just a who are you going to blame next type of game. So we'll see as the year develops, you know, with Paul Ryan's leadership style. I think he does have the advantage of getting a little bit of the benefit of the doubt from his party members right now, that they would like to see him successful. But for him to be successful as the leader of the majority party, he's got to get certain things done. We got to pass a budget so the government doesn't shut down. We have to pay our financial bills as great nations are supposed to in the year, and not default on our financial obligations for the first time, which could create a huge financial disaster for our country and for the global economy. So there are certain, you know, basic things that majority parties have to get done. And their failure to do that in the past led, I think, to Speaker Boehner's resignation. And it's going to be one of the tests coming up for Paul Ryan this year.
That's Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind here with us today to talk about current political issues on both the state and national level and what Wisconsinites can expect in the coming year. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. So another issue that's, you know, really been a part of the presidential campaign this year, but, you know, has been going on for maybe almost a year and a half now is the Black Lives Matter movement and this issue of racial inequality in our country and even getting at issues of police brutality and some of the problems in that system. So, you know, what are we kind of hearing on a national level as far as changes to be made? And
you know, the Black Lives Matters movement is real, and it really speaks to the issue that has been neglected, I think, for a very long time, and it's kind of the disparate treatment that certain segments of our national family have had to endure for years without the type of focus and without remedies being found. And they're elevating those issues now for the very first time. And I would hope policymakers, representatives at all level, take heed to the type of issues that are being raised, the type of discriminate treatment that certain people have had, and then think through by working with that what steps can be taken to make sure that we live up to the promise that all people are created equal under the eyes of this Constitution of ours, that everyone deserves equal opportunities and a fair shake in life. And clearly, our history has not been conducive to that, whether it's the remnants of slavery in our society to now the disparate treatment within law enforcement towards certain people. And unless you walk in their shoes, unless you adopt their skin color for even a day, it's sometimes hard for others to really realize just what has been going on in these communities and in these people's individual lives. But I think it has started an awakening in this nation, a long overdue conversation. But that conversation now has to be followed up with steps. And that is where the ultimate proof is going to lie.
Do you think that this is going to be maybe a motivational factor when people come to the polls in November?
Well, you know, people are motivated for a lot of different reasons in that, but we'll see what ultimate impact this has in the election season coming up. Obviously, the impact can be greater in certain areas given the concentration of people than others. I mean, I represent a district here in western Wisconsin that has about 4% minority representation, not a very diverse district at all. So it's going to be different from inner city Chicago or New York or L.A., for instance. But again, the Constitution does require us, at least at the federal level, to recognize that there are going to be people from different walks of life, different experiences in life that are going to bring different issues to the table. And as a nation, we need to have the ability to deal with all of that and not just get into our own little parochial neighborhood and just focus on that all the time.
We've been talking with Wisconsin's 3rd District U.S. Representative Ron Kind about current and upcoming political issues on the state and national level. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers.